Hello, hello, hello. That's phoning out there. Can you say something?
Hello, hello, hello.
Okay, that looks okay.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Right.
Worst case scenario, this becomes the famous lost episode of Let Me Sum Up.
The Lost Weekend. 2022.
If we never emerge from Sharm El Sheikh...
6 months later, their audio tape was found.
It's recording.
The Sharm El Sheikh Project. Okay.
This is Let Me Sum Up, your regular deep dive into recent reports on climate and energy. I'm Luke Menzel. We're recording today from a restaurant in the Labyrinthine Domina complex in Sharm El Sheikh. And I'm joined, as always, by my two co-hosts, Global Vice President for Marketing and Extortion at the Let Me Sum Up podcast, Frankie Muscovich.
Good evening. And isn't it fabulous to be sitting across from each other in three dimensions? It's great.
It is super fun. And it's been super fun the last week or two that I've been hanging out with you guys. And the other guy that I've been hanging out with for the last 2 weeks is shiny-assed wanker from The Big Smoke, Tennant Reid. Welcome, Tennant.
I am glad to have the endorsement of His Majesty's Minister of the Crown in the role that you described.
On this week's show, we're going through a rambling journey through the last 2 weeks of COP as we record. It's not done, team. It is Friday night at approximately 9:30 p.m. Negotiations continue to be underway, and I think the last time that you checked the interwebs, Tennant, negotiations on the finance element of the COP27 negotiations had been extended for another hour.
That's right, and I feel like they might just keep extending on for a while. I'm glad that we're not on the premises waiting for those to be done, that we're here getting some important work done by doing this podcast.
Indeed. So on this week's show, we're going to break with the format somewhat because we've been reading plenty of stuff, but it's largely been in draft form and it is evolving very quickly. So we're going to give you a bit of a vibe of what it's been like being here at COP27 over the last couple of weeks. Then we're going to dive into some of the substantive issues that have arisen over the last 2 weeks that are both material for the negotiations that are currently underway, but we expect to be significant in future COPs. And then we'll reflect on the future of some of the upcoming COPs, including the one that Australia may be hosting. Shall we get into it soon?
We shall.
All right, well, I guess the thing we've got to start with is where we're sitting now, which is in Egypt, which is, of course, in Africa. And this has been an Africa COP. What do you think that's meant for COP27? How has that distinguished it from previous COPs?
Well, I think this COP being an implementation COP is all about getting down to the business end of things. We've had, high-level agreements in previous COPs. We've got frameworks set up under the Glasgow Pact from last year's COP, and this is really about the rubber hitting the road and getting real about mitigation and adaptation on the ground. And I think nowhere is that perhaps profoundly demonstrated in a continent like Africa, where we have a lot of developing countries who are not responsible for the historic emissions that are in the atmosphere causing the climate change that we're currently dealing with. And so it's highly relevant to think about some of the issues that, have been dominating discussion at this COP, particularly around loss and damage, which is the conversation about how developed countries are going to effectively compensate developing countries for the extreme climate change fueled events that they're having to deal with and recover from. So it's, you know, it's really about what that means on the ground and getting down into the business end of managing an energy transition and getting stuck into adaptation, which has also been a really strong focus at this COP.
So I'd add two things there. One is that we all saw today an incredibly powerful message delivered by a 10-year-old girl from Ghana, Nakiet Dramani-Sam, who spoke very powerfully about the climate impacts and the fears that she and a whole generation of young people feel, and the loss and damage issue, pairing that with the need for greater effort by all parties, but particularly those with the most capacity, towards 1.5 degrees, towards avoiding as much of those impacts as possible in the first place. The other thing is that the question of loss and damage has really had this night and day different approach to it from developed and developing countries broadly. The developing country approach is very much who's going to pay for, compensate for, face liability for, in a different way of phrasing that, all those climate impacts. The developed country line to date, and we'll see how, if at all, this changes in the final outcome from this COP, has been, for a long time, don't talk much about loss and damage, but then in the Glasgow Pact, and then the discussion around that, it was very much, well, we're going to be providing technical assistance with responding to loss and damage and funding and finance in that context, not so much of when the houses have burnt down in a massive wildfire, paying to rebuild them, but more like paying for the training and equipment and development of a more effective emergency service to respond when that sort of thing happens. And while that's a useful thing, it's a very different thing to what a lot of countries are asking for. But, like, is any country going to sign up to unlimited liability for what is going to be a huge amount of global cost over coming decades? Like, probably not.
And it's been a fraught discussion, right? And you'd have to put part of that down to the fact that this is the first time that this issue has been formally on the agenda at a COP.
So, yes, except that there's a thing called the Warsaw International Mechanism for Loss and Damage, which was agreed like many COPs ago, and it's been around for a while, and I have no idea what it does, but it evidently doesn't do anything that has satisfied all these calls for loss and damage to be addressed. And I guess the fear that many countries will have out of this COP is it agrees a new thing in relation to loss and damage, and maybe that doesn't wind up 10 years later being understandable to anybody of what that does.
And, I mean, Tennant, you referenced this speech from that girl, and I just want to make sure that we give a, like, appropriate acknowledgement. I think it was a really powerful moment. It happened during a plenary, a stock take by the presidency, which is where they bring all the parties together, and, you know, there's a view from the presidency on how the negotiations are going. They give instructions for how they're going to continue. And it was, I mean, you know, not that we should call it a mic drop moment, but it was very powerful, apparently a very rare occurrence for, you know, a civilian to give that speech. She was she was 10 years old, and one of the things she said in her speech was, you know, Africa is a continent of pretty young people. Like, the average age is much lower than other parts of the world. And, you know, some of the things she said was, have a heart and do the maths, you know, on the plea on refocusing around trying to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. It came at a pretty critical time in the negotiations, still a lot of text to be resolved, and you know, she got a standing ovation in the room from all the parties present and everyone in there. It felt very special to be a part of that moment.
It was a remarkable moment. We're going to talk a little bit more about the state of play as we sit here on Friday evening a little bit later, but there is a sense that we're running behind. There's a lot of discord and fractiousness in the negotiations, particularly around the cover text and some of the big principles that the global community is nominally working towards. Backsliding on 1.5 degrees, this issue around loss and damage, you know, some of the blockbuster issues. And she was really speaking to those and speaking to those in an incredibly articulate way, and speaking, you know, very explicitly as a representative of young people that are going to inherit the planet that those of us that are a little bit older are going to be leaving behind. One of her lines, which was very powerful, was it was a great honour to meet John Kerry, who is turning 80 next year. By the time I turn 80, it'll be towards the end of this century, and that could be a very scary place for her. And so just, you know, this is ultimately, you know, what we're all doing, it can get very technical and seem very esoteric, but we are, you know, ultimately talking about, you know, people's lives and, you know, the quality of those lives and the continuation of those lives, and, you know, whether we're going to be living on a planet that is that is capable of sustaining human life in the way that we have understood it over millennia. And so, you know, it was a powerful reminder. I completely agree, and it was very special to be there for that moment.
I agree.
We should talk a little bit about the role of Australia in the negotiations. It's fair to say that Australia's presented a little differently at this COP compared to the last COP.
Dare I say we're back?
Dare I say, well, that has been the rallying call from Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen. Australia is back is the tagline of this COP from an Australian government perspective. And, you know, I guess that was sort of evident from everything through the design of Australia's pavilion. It was a hubbub of activity. Yeah. Certainly the week that I've been here and the second week, Team Australia was very much present all the time. But whether we put it down to the free coffee from the DQ folk manning the coffee machine to the, I think, just a very kind of welcoming and inclusive sort of environment crafted. There were, you know, lots of places for people to stand around and chat. There was a little event space there for talks that we were hosting.
Yep.
It was sort of open and welcoming, and it had a very warm feeling to it. And I think a lot of people commented on that.
They gravitated towards it. And I suppose the context for our listeners that have never been to a conference of parties is that, you know, there's the negotiations which are happening in informal spaces in specific rooms, and, you know, they're being you know, announced on a daily basis. You know, they're fairly well understood what the schedule is in the first week, and then it gets a little bit harder to follow in the second week. Stuff bounces around, so you've got to stay on top of it. That's one track. But the other track, of course, is there's the pavilion. And, you know, you've got nations from around the world, as well as civil society organisations, environmental groups, universities, all kinds of different organisations taking out booths. And the national booths are really interesting because they're custom designed. They're, you know, they're an expression of, like, the nation's sort of self-image and, you know, what they're trying to achieve at the COP. They've often got a space that you can hang out and another space where there's talks going on. And the Australian Pavilion was notable because it was, you know, the space where you hung out was very open, it was very welcoming. As you say, Frankie, they were, you know, the Australian Pavilion quickly developed the reputation of having the best coffee at COP.
And the wines just grew. So Tennant and I were there for the whole 2 weeks. So it was sort of these, you know, sort of this ragtag bunch of Australians that had sort of coughed. The coffee was pretty good at the start of the week, and there was like four or five people in the line at every given point. It was stretching as far as the eye could see by the end of the 2 weeks. And, you know, folk were coming and felt welcome to do that. And that was sort of emblematic of, you know, this new attitude that Australia was taking to the broader sort of task of participating and engaging and contributing to the climate space. And so that was fun. It was nice to be around, and it became a hub for the Australian community in a way that I understand, Tennant. It hasn't so much been the case in many previous COPs where there hasn't been a home base for Team Australia.
Yeah, that's right. So at the COPs that I attended previously in Paris, in Katowice, in Madrid, there was no Australian pavilion. There was at Glasgow, but I wasn't there. And, you know, there would be a briefing from the Australian delegation to Australian attendees once a week. There would be chats in the corridor. But otherwise, you know, we're all pretty dispersed. And the role that Australia played in those negotiations, like, often it was very constructive behind the scenes, but there were some overt episodes which were not so constructive, including the fairly hardball push that Australia made for carryover of overperformance against our Kyoto targets towards Paris, which was seen as pretty offensive by a lot of other nations. And also back in Katowice, when we were the one ally to come along and stand by the Trump administration in putting its view of the energy future for the world in a deliberately provocative side event. So, you know, it has become a cliche in the past fortnight, but it's true. We are back. We've got to sort of live up to the claims that we are making about both the strength of our domestic transformation and how constructive and present we're going to be in both assisting our region and playing this global role. But I think the government and Minister Bowen have made a good first impression, and the work that the minister was asked to do by the Egyptian presidency looks like it may have been quite successful, and certainly very important if we want to talk about that.
Yeah, so Minister Bowen, for the first time in some time, I understand, was asked to lead negotiations on a very critical element of the COP27 agenda, right?
Yeah, I think he was asked in collaboration, I think, with the Indian minister to shepherd home the final text on the future of financing, or the financing part, which is a little bit hairy because, you know, there is no shortage of controversial issues in the finance part of the negotiations, including...
There's 100 billion of them.
Yes, exactly. Where is the 100 billion, and what is going to replace that come 2025? So I thought, you know, it was really significant that he was given that opportunity. We attended an informal meeting on the future of financing text earlier today, and it looked as though the main part of the text was agreed in that meeting, although they're still going, I think, as we noted. Not exactly sure what they're talking about now, but
I think what was agreed was all the way back at Copenhagen and then again at Paris, the developed world committed that climate finance, broadly defined, to the developing world from the rich world, would scale up to $100 billion a year by 2020. And it hasn't. It, depending on how you count it, they may have got 80% of the way there. But it hasn't hit that goal, and so one stream of things is arguing about, well, when are you going to meet it, you deadbeats? But the other part is, okay, well, that was the 2020 goal. what next? And I think that the steps around the what next, they're meant next year to agree a new collective quantified global goal, the NCQGG. It's one, not even the worst acronym in this process. And I don't know how close they're going to get, but, geez, they can't have spent the last 3 hours arguing entirely about how much to appreciate Australia, which was a thing.
It was a thing. Do we need to go there?
We don't
on that
need to
one?
Go there.
I don't think so.
Check Twitter.
Yeah.
If it still exists by the time you listen to this.
A short side note, we were all in the room when Chris Bowen gave his national address, and the head of every country's delegation gets to make a speech in the plenary hall, and I thought it was really significant and a really nice moment when he started by giving a greeting in the language of the traditional owners of the Torres Strait Islands. And I thought that was just a significant sort of reset in the way that we present in these forums. Annie, continued to go on and restate the way that the new government has increased ambition on a range of fronts, including the 2030 target, share of renewables by 2030, amongst other things. So, I think we've been prominent at this COP, if I can put it that way, and we've been given some real responsibility, and it looks like the minister embraced the challenge. So we'll wait and see what the final result yields, but it certainly does feel like Australia's back in that sense. One of the other things that I think has struck all of us while we've been here as well, and this has been my first COP, so I don't have much of a frame of reference for this, but others have certainly remarked on it, was the balance of, I guess, where the energy and the dialogue is sort of focused in the COP. So, obviously negotiations are happening. This being an implementation COP, a lot of the negotiations were very, down in the weeds, in the technical detail. And so a lot of the people sort of out and about are saying, actually, a lot of the action is out there in the pavilions, in the side events, where you've got, luminaries speaking on key issues and really sort of, evolving the discussion on some of the things that, we're all here to talk about. I thought it was an interesting perception that seems to be shared across a number of stakeholders, that the balance of where the real action was at this COP seems to have shifted a bit away from the negotiations and towards the pavilions and the side events. What did you guys make of that?
We were saying before that you've got all of these national pavilions and these various NGOs that have set up pavilions, and they all have their own sort of programs. There's some that are absolutely outstanding, and there's others that are okay. And it is incumbent upon you as a participant in COP to go around and wander around the various pavilions and find out what's going on. But if you do that, if you put the time in, there are some incredible sessions going on, like world-leading experts. Indeed, the learning rates paper that we covered on the episode a couple of weeks ago, the professor at Oxford University that led that work,
Cameron Hepburn himself,
delivered an outstanding keynote that Ten and I were able to catch. Unfortunately, it was before you arrived, Frankie, but it was far and away my favourite thing that I saw over the course of COP. There was a hilarious joke which we have to share with our listeners.
So, can I set it up?
Sure, off you go.
Well, there was a lot of discussion, of course, of better ways of assessing future costs of technologies. Somebody in the audience, it may have been Luke, asked the panel, what was their opinion of integrated assessment models?
No. Given... I haven't heard this story.
Oh, it's a cracker. What do you think about integrated assessment models given the work that you've done? And they said...
They said that integrated assessment models should be treated as stranded assets.
And...
Oh, snap.
And that their designers needed a just transition. to new forms of employment.
Which, look, fair to say, in the audience...
he's starting a flame war from Sharm el-Sheikh.
Well, look, what I will say is that, you know, it was a pretty, pretty packed session. Not many other people were getting the joke. Tennant and I were in the front row, cacking ourselves laughing. Yeah.
We provided all the appreciation that crowded room could not. So...
Oh, they would have been looking at you like you're a bunch of loonies. I'm really sorry I missed that.
The panel was delighted. They were in on the joke.
Which was
just super fun. But it speaks to, I suppose, one element of the what's going on in the pavilions, which is, you know, world-leading experts, bringing their latest thinking to... And, you know, if you engage and you sort of seek it out, then you can partake. But the other element of the pavilions, which was really noticeable for me, and, again, my first COP as well, I understand this is a development that has been perhaps present in previous COPs, but it is gaining momentum, is just the amount of time and application of attention that is being paid and to sharing the latest on sort of business frameworks for decarbonisation. Mm-hmm. So the two that stood out for me was the report from the UK's Transition Plan Task Force, is a pre-regulatory framework for transition plans, which in 2023 the UK government plans to add to its disclosure framework. There's already a requirement that companies over a certain threshold need to disclose under TCFD in the UK. The plan is that they also need to disclose a transition plan, which is effectively the way that they're operationalising their net zero commitments in detail. The UK government, as part of Glasgow, made this commitment, but there wasn't really a best practice model that they felt they could point to for what that transition plan should look like. So they commissioned the UK's Transition Plan Task Force to develop that model. That was released at Glasgow, and that's now driving a global conversation, including in Australia, about the role of transition plans right around the world. There's also ISO has released a framework for net zero definitions. One of the issues we have around, you know, the whole concept of net zero is that, you know, people define all the terminology in slightly different ways, which makes it very difficult to judge the commitments that are being made and how they're being followed through on. And that's just a couple of examples among a plethora of examples. And so you can see, I don't know if it's fair to say that the COP is almost bifurcating, where you've got the negotiation stream, which is this the high level sort of global policy architecture for driving a decarbonisation pathway for the world. But then you've got this whole conversation about, well, how do we support businesses on this transition pathway, and how do we make sure there's integrity and accountability and transparency around the net zero commitments that are coming thick and fast from many of the world's leading businesses. So I think that was incredibly encouraging, and as I understand it, is a relatively new thing when it comes to COPs, and is a theme that I think we can expect to continue gathering momentum.
There was one area where I thought there should be more dialogue between the pavilion events, side events, and the negotiations, and that was my old favourite, CBAM.
What was your...
We've made it about half an hour into the conversation. Thank you for waiting that long before bringing CBAMs in.
Inhuman resolve.
Yeah. You've been bristling for the last half an hour.
What was your favourite session of COP27?
Well, it was a side event that I was on.
Side event featuring one T. Reid.
Yes, it was a side event at the Moroccan Pavilion on carbon border adjustment mechanisms and understanding. Kelsey, please. And understanding the effects of the European one in particular. And the reason why I liked it so much was actually several fold. One was I'd been having a pretty crap day up till then. The food, as many, many people have said, the food at this COP has been really bad, really overpriced, really scarce a lot of the time, certainly in that first week. And, you know, hungry people feeling a bit low. That's not the environment you want for your cop. But this CBAM panel lifted my whole day. Not just because there was like a group of people at whom I could talk about CBAM, but because actually there was like five or six luminous CBAM experts from different fields, Chinese energy consultancies, market operators, like exchange operators from the United States and Europe, all sorts of like environment NGOs with a strong view on this. And there's just so much knowledge out there and deep thinking going on in parts of stakeholder land about this relatively new topic. So I learned some interesting things in the course of that presentation, including the view of some in China that they actually have very little exposure to Europe's CBAM and probably any others, that the kind of products that are likely to be covered are only about 1% of the value of China's exports, for instance. But on CBAM, I learnt two other things. One is there's a wide range of levels of understanding in stakeholder land and a lot of fears in stakeholder land, including fears from European businesses that they're going to lose competitiveness with CBAM because they haven't invested in clean production in the 20 years that they've been getting free allocation, say some themselves, and they're going to be driven into the ground by new, clean, big manufacturing facilities in China, in America, in other places. That was a surprising one to me. But CBAM isn't formally in the negotiations at all. It's a matter for... It's a trade matter, so it's an issue for the WTO.
But the power of CBAM is such that it's been forcing itself in discussions, Tenet.
Well, the power of the like-minded developing countries, which is a group including China and India and Saudi Arabia and a number of others, that hunt as a pack in these negotiations at times, they were trying to stick CBAMs onto the agenda of the Forum on Response Measures, which is usually the place where petroleum exporting countries get together to complain about how awful it would be if people stopped buying petroleum and wouldn't they need some special consideration in that circumstance. They were saying how awful it would be if they were hit by a CBAM and shouldn't we have some consideration of the negative impacts on them. And they weren't able to get that on the agenda because these things require consensus, and the United States, the United Kingdom, and I presume Europe said, bugger off. We're not talking about that. And I think they're actually wrong. I think they should talk about it, because if they did, if they had workshops with the kind of experts who were on this panel that I participated in and plenty of others, I think everybody would calm the heck down about CBAM.
I attended an event about CBAM. So I went to the EU Pavilion and heard from a bunch of people. And like the message that was coming from them, I sort of only want to bring that up to comment on the vibe, because you said the EU didn't support it getting on the agenda. Hmm. But the overall kind of message coming out of that panel, which was mostly Europeans, was it's nothing to be afraid of. Think of it as an incentive.
Yes.
They were, you know, really wanting to kind of ease people's minds about what this might mean for them. I'm like, yeah, I think it's interesting in that context.
And that message probably would be more persuasive coming from people who are not Europe.
Absolutely.
I gave a presentation to some European diplomats back in Australia a couple of months ago, and they thought they were having to gear up to receive a bollocking from ornery Australians not wanting impositions on trade. They were very surprised and pleased by what I had to say about CBAM, but I think we do need more discussion of this. But with that said, maybe we should talk about another great presentation that you saw, Frankie.
I saw many great presentations in the week that I've been here. One that particularly sticks in mind for me was a great one on unpacking some of the detail in the Inflation Reduction Act.
What's that?
Yes, well, it's only the single biggest spending commitment on climate in history, really, if you want to kind of do that kind of writ large. It's a huge amount of funding passed by the Biden administration within the... When did that pass? Within the last 6 months?
Yeah, 3 months ago.
It was significant in the sense that it got over the line through the American Congress. You had Democratic senators like Joe Manchin, who are, you know, notoriously elusive on more progressive matters, and so, you know, this managed to sway his vote in favour, and so we've got this enormous funding commitment. I forget the overall figure.
Hundreds of billions of dollars in direct spend,
yeah,
and potentially unlocking more than $1 trillion in private finance.
The headline is sort of over $1 trillion, but that's some of that. That's indirect. Yep. And so the point being, it's only passed a few months ago and there's a lot in it. So it was great to have a few US policy officials sit down and kind of talk about their favorite elements of the IRA. There are people that objected to that IRA. Shorthand, IRA. Because there's so much in it that there'll be, you know, Easter eggs all through the thing that people haven't heard about.
Oh, so I didn't catch the whole session, but I caught the back half of it. And I really enjoyed, and I think it was in response to your question, because you jumped up and asked a question, they were geeking out about the opportunity around electrification and heat pumps.
Absolutely.
And, you know, very bullish on the role of that technology in supporting decarbonisation in the building sector in the US, along with weatherisation or, you know, improving the thermal performance of buildings. If anything, they say they were feeling a bit sad because they wanted to do more in that space. But it was striking to me, and Frankie and I were in Europe earlier in the year, hearing very clearly from Europeans, from Germany and from France and from Belgium and to some degree from the UK as well, you know, that this was a kind of a cornerstone technology.
Yep.
Very, very similar sort of vibe from the US. And I feel like that same kind of zeitgeist hasn't quite broken in Australia.
Yeah.
Like it has in the kind of the nerd circles that we circulate in. There's a recognition that electrification is going to be critical both for decarbonisation but also, a pathway through some of the energy challenges that we're immediately facing.
Yeah.
But it was sort of interesting getting that US perspective, and there's clearly a wave of heat pump mania sweeping the world.
Yeah, and it's not as though the measures that they were talking about were very specifically targeted at heat pumps per se, but would allow for that, and they imagine that's where a lot of, you know, demand for incentives were coming from. So one of the people on the panel was the head of policy for the Democratic senator and sort of, you know, leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, so, you know, can speak with authority on the matter. And so, of course, when I think he'd, through the course of the presentation, talked about some of the tax credit measures that they thought would drive activity in building upgrades, being the buildings wonk in the audience, jumped up and said, care to reflect any more on some of the buildings related things in the IRA? And they talked about what they, yeah, I think to your, the thing that you're alluding to there is a couple of tax credits that they expect to kind of work in unison ongoing. So there's a I know it's sort of shorthand, and I'm not going to bother with the long form, but there's a 25D tax credit, which is really providing an incentive towards solar, and that's been around a while. And the new credit, 25C, is for other appliances like heat pumps, or with a focus on energy efficiency that they think combined together, because they're similar mechanisms. If you're sort of accessing one, it makes sense to access the other at the same time. They think could drive a huge amount of activity. Although it's interesting, again, because I went down the buildings rabbit hole with them, as I'm wont to do. I asked about measures that that were targeting commercial buildings. I think there they sort of admitted they have a lot more work to do in the US. But what they did say was that they allocated $27 billion to a green bank, and about at least I think $20 billion of that is sort of ring-fenced for uses in ways in which that they thought would very much largely be directed at building retrofits. So when they, I guess what they talked about was when they didn't have the details of the particular policy intervention nutted out, and buildings they thought was a huge opportunity. They remarked on the cost effectiveness of building upgrades from a cost benefit perspective, which is a threshold test that most policy changes in Australia have to pass. They're like, it's so cheap. Of course it is cheap to regulate and get the private sector to carry the cost of it. So they're very in favour of measures targeting buildings, because you get huge amounts of bang for your buck in terms of emissions reduction. So it was just sort of fascinating to hear, that level of detail coming from US officials, which you haven't had a lot of opportunity to engage with.
And incredibly helpful, for Australia, where we are in our policy process. With just last week, as we record, the federal government releasing its National Energy Performance Strategy consultation paper.
Yep.
You've now got, two really big jurisdictions in Europe and in the US sort of really leaning into this space, mm-hmm. and sort of some prior art from both of those perspectives. And Australia does really look to some of that work that is done in the US and Europe and draws different strands from those different jurisdictions. And so I think it's incredibly helpful to see what they're pursuing, and it's not to say we fire up the photocopier, but it does provide some inspiration for what we could pursue in Oz.
And in both of those other jurisdictions, in the US and the EU writ large, I mean, IRA, it's sort of, aiming to do what it says on the label, which is reduce inflation.
Yep.
And, and the other, and that's certainly been a stated purpose in a lot of the Fit for 55 policy work in Europe, which is also very much driven by the need to keep energy costs down in the global energy crisis that we're in, because everyone's suffering from high gas prices. And, I think unlike Australia to date, those jurisdictions have had a really strong focus on energy efficiency, because it is one of the only things, that can be done that isn't, potentially inflationary and can cut people's energy bills. So, that's a really exciting prospect in an Australian context. And, I know we're all kind of looking into that in our day jobs. So it was great to hear a little bit more meat on the bones from the folks over in the US on the IRA.
All right. I think we've done a reasonable job of giving a sense of the vibe around the pavilions. Shall we talk about the negotiations?
As we speak, I've just seen that the finance negotiations have been extended further to 11 p.m. local time.
Oh, dear.
I don't see any reason why they wouldn't just keep extending them through to 2 or 3 a.m. or whenever the negotiators fall asleep at their posts.
Oh, dear.
And to be clear, these are the negotiations which Minister Bowen
was shepherding, and then all of the various key topic areas that ministers had been assigned to facilitate were taken back by the presidency and the presidency of the COP, the Egyptians were taking it from there.
So I think we should say that the negotiations are in flight. This episode will go up in a few days. This will all be done and dusted by the time you're listening, so we're not going to spend too much time on the blow-by-blow at 10-11 p.m. in Sharm el-Sheikh, because that'll all be fish and chip wrappers by the time that you're hearing this. But there are some emerging themes that have come out of Sharm that, you know, I think are pretty clear are going to, you know, continue to be really significant points of discussion as we move through the next few years in terms of the global climate conversation. The one for me, which is head and shoulders above the rest because it goes to the ambition of the enterprise that we're undertaking, because of, you know, what we're shooting for, you know, that's what defines everything that sits under it, is the debate, which was starting to fire up in the lead up to this COP and has been really present in this COP, around whether 1.5 degrees is lost. And there has been various, you know, factions sort of within the signatories to the UNFCCC that have taken very different views on that. And it looks like, as we sit here, that, you know, 1.5 abides. But I guess the question is whether this is something that we're going to continue returning to over subsequent years.
It really depends on how we do. In terms of short-term ambition, now, I think 2030 is very much short-term. We've had strengthening over the past couple of years by many parties, but it's far short of what you would need to see for a world that stays below 1.5 degrees. On the other hand, the strengthening of the long-term commitments over the past couple of years has been a very big deal, and the International Energy Agency has come out with an upgrade of their forecast, which suggests that the latest round of deals, especially the commitment to finance the developed countries to finance the closure and replacement of Indonesia's coal-fired power stations, has lowered the total expected warming if everybody fulfills everything that they've committed to now from 1.8 degrees of warming to 1.7. But that's currently a big and remarkable if. Is everybody going to do what they've committed to? Are we going to fill in the blanks over this decade of delivery and implementation? Or are things going to look a bit thin and patchy? And the COP can't answer that. Countries can answer that in their actions at home. The COP can encourage countries or call on them, depending on which might be stronger. There's a whole dictionary of terminology in UN decisions. It can chivvy them along, but it can't make them do anything.
Which is always the case, but for those listeners that are looking for the, you know, the glass half full perspective, you know, the IEA sort of modelling that you know, Tennant's speaking to outlines that, you know, heading into Glasgow, you know, the pledges that were on the table, you know, we're going to get us to 2.1 degrees. After Glasgow, we got down to 1.8, and just out of the G20 meeting that took place last weekend, we're down to 1.7. So that's significant progress in terms of ambition over the last couple of years, and this, of course, we need to follow through on it. But the kind of the pledges that are being put on the table are starting to get into the right ballpark. Now, the important caveat around that is their long term pledges. They're talking about 2050. You know, the issue of the cumulative carbon emissions that we're putting in the atmosphere, and, you know, the ambition of what is supposed to be happening over the next 7 years to 2030, and beyond that to 2035. It's something we still need to be extremely concerned about. But, you know, we are moving in the right
direction in terms of formal commitments from countries. But there is this, you know, back and forth around 1.5, whether that's something to shoot for, and whether it's pragmatic to say, well, it's implausible to achieve, and so we should be thinking and preparing for a world in which we overshoot, or, you know, the alternative view is, just, well, we overshoot 1.5, we overshoot 1.7 and 1.9 and 2, and, like, where does it all stop? Like, we've got to sort of maintain that line in the sand and continue to do everything we can to meet it.
Mm. There's a couple of things in this for me. One, we should remark on Australia's role in leading the call for maintaining the fight to keep 1.5 alive. Our head of delegation was speaking on behalf of the bloc of countries that we sit in.
The umbrella group.
For the purposes
of not the Umbrella Corporation, any Resident Evil players out there.
And pushed very hard on that in one of the first heads of delegation meetings that we attended. And I think it's interesting that, you know, as the negotiations have evolved over the last few days, that question about the line on 1.5 is now being linked to the debate around loss and damage.
Yes.
Yeah, they're being linked in the negotiations in that you see the balance of developing countries wanting to see a very strong commitment to a facility and a mechanism for finance provided to those countries for loss and damage agreed to out of this COP, you know, details to be finalised and all that, but a really firm commitment, to getting a mechanism and a mosaic of ways of getting finance for that. And that sort of being used as a bit of a bargaining chip by other countries, including the EU, who have said, well, you know, and have, I guess, made representations and sort of compromised positions, over the last day or so that, okay, we can meet you on some of that if we get really strong recommitment and language around keeping 1.5 degrees alive. I think it's been very interesting to me that those two issues have been really strongly linked in the context also of some of the commentary we saw in some of the panels where we attended, we sort of had EU leaders like Frans Timmermans, Vice President of the EU Commission, waxing lyrical about the, economic prosperity benefits of growing a green hydrogen trade in Africa. Yep. Whereas the African perspective in some of those discussions, we also want the, ability to keep developing gas for our, economic prosperity, to sell to the EU, by the way, and didn't want to be limited in that way. I think it's a really complex dynamic there.
Yeah. And complex views inside these countries, just as we have complex views inside Australia.
Yep.
Yep.
Absolutely. Hey, should we talk Article 6?
Well, should we, is a question. So Article 6 is the bit of the Paris Agreement that goes to cooperative approaches between countries to reduce emissions, and it's got three bits, a bit about when they transfer mitigation outcomes from one country to another and how do you account for that in a kosher way. It's got a bit on a new global market mechanism for crediting emissions reductions and exchanging them. And it's got a bit about non-market approaches, non-market forms of cooperation, which is still really being defined. And in previous years, this has been a really high-profile arena for stoushes with, big advocates of market mechanisms as a way of reducing costs and increasing what we can actually achieve in emissions reduction versus people worried about either fake credits, hot air,
or bad projects that impinge on human rights or Indigenous people's lands. This time, it hasn't really been... Like, some people have tried to make it that again, but really, it seems to have been a just horrifyingly detailed slog through the micro nitty-gritty of turning all the previous rules into... incredibly detailed guidance for the bodies that are going to carry forward the implementation of these mechanisms. And, like, even seasoned Article 6 watchers have been, like, befuddled and more than slightly annoyed by the negotiations they've watched. The negotiators seem pretty baffled. And it's just not the side of the big fights this time. Even though it's still a big deal.
It hasn't really been where the attention's been focused. And it's almost been, for those that have been following this for a long time, particularly at COPs, almost a little bit surprising. It's like... Article 6 isn't that interesting this year. And everyone's like not quite sure what to do with themselves because it was really clear what the big game in town was in previous COPs.
Yeah. Like, even people whose whole job is Article 6 have been saying... Maybe go out and have a look in the National Pavilions. That's where the real action is this year.
There you go. Well, maybe that's all we need to say about Article 6. I guess my question to you two, because we're running pretty long, is there anything else, any other big issues in the negotiations that you think it's really important for our listeners to be on top of?
Well, we touched on finance earlier, but I think what hadn't been resolved in the text when we had last seen it around the future of climate financing was the dollar figures that might be attributed to a range of funds into the future, and that's entirely a political discussion. And so by the time you're all listening to this, those things would be filled in, but they were question marks as of when we last had a look.
Yeah, and the finance question is, it's a big deal. Both because it's the sine qua non, as the ambassador for Pakistan said on behalf of the group of 77 plus China of these negotiations. It's the glue that helps bind decisions together. It's obviously very necessary for there to be public finance, especially for adaptation, to help countries adapt. But the developed countries are quite insistent that private finance be counted in this discussion, that has an important role to play. And it really does. Like, the energy transition is going to be ultimately quite a profitable thing. It's not something that just needs public finance to summon it into being. But wind, solar, batteries, electrolyzers, these are capital-heavy things. The costs of them are largely in the initial construction. And developing countries overall have a systematically higher cost of capital than developed countries. So even taking in the... Actually, based on that Oxford paper, a hell of a lot of this transition is going to pay for itself. It's still the case that accessibility of finance and cost of capital is a very big deal for an equitable transition. And we've got further to go on that.
Which is it underlines how all of these issues are so interlinked, because you go, well, we want that support for loss and damage, but the developed countries saying, well, we want you to commit to 1.5 degrees and sort of push that through. It's like, well, our ability to pursue the technologies that will allow us to pursue 1.5 is linked back to the availability of capital and our ability to, you know, deploy that in that clean energy transition. You know, it's the Rubik's Cube, and every time you flip one block, like, everything else gets out of line, which is why these negotiations are so complex. Any final calls on negotiation?
I think then my last word on the negotiations, I don't want to let the global goal on adaptation go without a mention. It's a really significant issue, and I think to the extent that we got some updates on how that's going, really it's just that the most meaningful way to put a goal and to be able to track progress against that, because there's been like a qualitative goal, you know, agreed in this space before. So how do you actually measure progress against that goal? And that looks very different. Yeah, that looks very different depending on which parts of our society and economy that you look at. Like, that's not an easy exercise to go through. So that's actually one of the areas I want to go back and have a look at, you know, where they get to this time around. I think that's going to absolutely need to continue to evolve as our understanding of adaptation increases over time as well.
It's time for One More Thing, where we share something that's currently captivating our attention. Frankie, what have you got?
Unsurprisingly, it's a cop-related One More Thing.
Shock horror.
Shock horror.
Tell me more.
I'm going to talk about future cops.
Robocops.
That wasn't on my list, but I can add it there for posterity. So, while we've been here at COP27, we had Minister Chris Bowen give his address, at which he told the Conference of Parties that Australia would very much like to host the 31st COP in 2026 in partnership with our Pacific family. So, the offer was made. Interestingly, it was made a few speeches after the minister from Turkey, who also offered or indeed pitched up to host COP31. So we are not without competition in our bid to host in 2026. So that will be an interesting one to watch. Word on the street, and by street I mean the dusty cobblestoned roads between COP pavilions, is that it's looking reasonably positive for Australia. We'll see how that goes. The other one on future COPs I wanted to mention was next year's COP is in the UAE. It'll be in Dubai, and we got the official dates.
30th of November 2023 to the
November
12th of December.
Till 12th of December, so a little later in the year than this one. And we were lucky enough at the bingo briefing this morning to get a little bit of an insight from a member of the presidency there.
What is the bingo briefing, Frankie?
The bingo briefing, and Tennant's probably a better place to say this, but it's a briefing given by the International
Chamber of Commerce. Convened by them?
Yes, for the business community here at COP.
Business and industry non-government organisations.
Okay.
Bingo.
Bingo. So, so we had Dane McQueen join the bingo briefing from the UAE presidency, and he spoke about the thematics that would be important to a UAE-hosted COP. Energy transition was pretty high on the list. They're very much looking at the role of renewables and hydrogen. They also up front highlighted the role of financing, both public and private, in adaptation, and that will be very relevant given the conversation at this COP around loss and damage and the future of financing. Other ones I think of note, and I actually thought it was interesting that he specifically raised the idea of inclusivity and having a focus on gender and youth in a very purposeful way. that'll be interesting to watch. I think they talked about having a youth ambassador as part
as the high level champion. That's right.
So that, yeah, I think that's sort of a positive idea, and it'll be useful to watch. The other COPs from between COP28 in the UAE and prospective Australian COP31 would be in Eastern Europe, the year following the UAE. It's looking like that could be Prague, although other people had it in Bulgaria, so we'll wait and see. And COP30 the following year is shaping up to be in Brazil. That has to be in Latin America.
Yep.
But Lula was waxing lyrical about hosting it in the Amazon, so we'll see how that goes. That's my one more thing.
Super exciting. Tennant, what have you got?
Well, I would like to promote a series of videos from the sidelines of COP27 recorded by one Luke Menzel. And often involving Frankie and or me, but also a rotating cast of guest luminaries that we just grabbed by the elbow and hauled out of the corridors of the COP and into the limelight.
Into the limelight. This was their one big chance. Richie right. Merzian, welcome to the public stage. That's what I'd say.
Darren Miller. Yes, you daylight as the head of Arena, but you moonlight as a video star with John Kerry in our videos. So we'll put the link in the show notes, but these are a great guide to some of what was going on in the COP, and just a rollicking good time, especially our absolutely essential COP goodie bag unboxing video.
Which shockingly hasn't got the YouTube juice that I expected to.
So until now.
My expectation is that every single summer upper listening to this episode is going to jump on that link right now to see the essential unboxing / unbagging of the Sharm El Sheikh COP27 goodie bag.
Don't waste your time.
Come on.
They did it before I arrived. They didn't even, like, preload the bag with stuff that wasn't, like, crappy pencils and notepads. You literally tried to make the most boring office accessory.
That's a spoiler. Thing. That is a spoiler for our goodie bag.
I don't care.
That's getting edited out.
All right.
What's your one more thing, Luke?
My one more thing is, we're getting close to our very first holiday season here at the Let Me Sum Up podcast, and we wanted to do something special. So at some point in December, we're, instead of reading a report about climate or energy and talking about it, we're going to watch a movie about climate and talk about it. And there's been, you know, many discussions about what this movie should be. As it turns out, when you actually look for climate related movies that are sort of properly about climate and not just climate adjacent, there's not that many of them. And we considered just choosing amongst ourselves, but we wanted to let the Summer Opera community have their say. So we were intending to set up a Twitter poll. The future of Twitter as we record is very uncertain. So it may be a Survey Monkey or some such thing, but we're very hopeful that over the next few weeks you'll jump onto whatever this survey that emerges is online, and it'll be in the show notes and in our socials and so forth, to tell us which movie you would like us to watch and talk about. So as you're sitting on the beach or wherever you are right around the world, you're listening to the movie that you would prefer us to talk about. So the movies are Soylent Green, which Tennant put on the agenda, and Swears Black and Blue is a climate related movie.
I continue to swear this. And there's only one way that you can prove me wrong.
Yeah. So Soylent Green is number one. Number two is The Day After Tomorrow, which is a very explicitly sort of climate related disaster movie. And the third one, relatively recent, satire, acerbic commentary on the climate crisis, Don't Look Up. So what would you like the three of us to watch and talk about, dear listeners? Well, there's only one way to tell us, is to jump on the link that is in the show notes as you speak and click on the movie that you think that we should talk about.
Vote. Do it now. And while you're voting... like, subscribe, rate, review. Love this podcast. Come on, guys.
Love this podcast like it loves you.
We travelled halfway across the world to bring you good content. We've been enslaved to the cause for the last couple of weeks. And the last time we brought you sugar and spice, it didn't lead to many likes, subscribes, rates, and review. So I don't know what else we can do, but I'm hoping our odyssey over here to Sharm El Sheikh and our last hour kind of plea to you.
Last hour?
I don't know. It's getting late.
We're all a little bit tired.
It's punchy. The end of a long couple of weeks.
Here's what I'll say. For all of you just laughing along at home to the
just
sugar
rate
and spice,
the podcast, people.
You all love the sugar and spice content. You go, ha, 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 sugar and spice. This is hilarious. Go bloody rate the podcast. Like, literally, go to Apple Podcasts, go click on the like button and write a review. It'll take you literally 30 seconds. I know this is your domain, Frankie, the spice.
I don't know. I think we're moving beyond spice here. I think sugar spice blunt force trauma.
Deployed strategically. Let's see if it makes any difference this time.
Okay, that's not a threat, except when it is.
All right, well, that is our show today. We need to go to bed.
We do.
Frankie is on Twitter, at least for the next 48 hours. Frankie, what's your Twitter handle?
For the time being, it's at Frankie Muscovich.
And Tennant, what's your Twitter handle?
Well, I hope it's not at Smoking Hole in the Ground. And if not, it's at Tennant Red.
Never miss an episode by subscribing to Let Me Sum Up in your podcast app. And you'll find the full back catalogue of episodes at letmesumup.net. But for Frankie Muscovich and Tennant Reed, reporting live from COP27, Sharm El Sheikh in Egypt, I'm Luke Menzel. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you soon.